I was in the Devon Vihar, which is quite far away from any town, and taxi pulls up, and a woman rushes into the Vihar and says, "Ajahn Sumedho, I've got 15 minutes, the taxi's waiting." Say something wise. I feel like one of those vending machines. One thing I always notice is that when people ask me to give a talk or say something wise, my mind goes completely blank. But that is, like, wisdom in the Buddhist sense is, you know, it's not a intellectual thing. So it's more, it's kind of an intuitive discerning ability. And so wisdom, you know, even though the Western countries are very clever, they've developed the intellect and manipulating conditions to create all kinds of miraculous technology. They created fantastic nuclear weapons, and they've been able to pollute the planet. Not to mention making computers, internet, and so forth. So on the technical, on the conditioned side, the thinking mind, the ability to manipulate the four elements and the conditions is, we have developed that ability to a high degree. But also we've lost something in the process, is that we've done it without wisdom. So you realize so much of our intelligence and skills have been in weapon making, destructive war machines and whatnot. So how much of the national budget is for things of that nature? So, you know, when during the Cold War, you know, it was a ludicrous joke about the Soviet Union and the United States that could overkill the whole planet 20 times over or something. A way of scaring each other into not doing anything. Or the very basis of wisdom is, people ask, you know, about difference between Tibetan tradition and Theravada, and the Tibetan now is mentioned compassion as their kind of chief, is their kind of approach to everything, compassion, the Bodhisattva, and then in Theravada it's wisdom and liberation. So these are, you know, so then the intellect sees them as, should I choose to become a compassionate bodhisattva or just a selfish arahant? I'll get enlightened, I don't care what happens to you. But these are the, you know, deductions that one has on the intellectual side of compassion and wisdom. But in intuitive awareness, then they're not opposed to each other in any way. It's not a matter of choice. Maybe it's a matter of emphasis, and that's all, you know, that one needs to see. Tibetan tradition isn't lacking in wisdom because it emphasizes compassion, or Theravada lacking in compassion because its emphasis is on wisdom. So we, on the intellect, then, you know, it's a dualistic function of the mind. So if you have heaven, you have hell, you have God, you have the devil. Everything, you have one, you have its opposite. And that's the conditioned realm. And then it's a critical function. We use it to, you know, compare, analyze, criticize. You know, this is bigger or this is smaller. Well, are just even very practical ways of living in this realm, in the conditioned realm that we're born into. But without wisdom, then we can easily delude ourselves. We can become megalomaniacs and tyrants easily, or just underestimate ourselves in various ways. Power is a very attractive energy, to feel powerful and dominant. One doesn't like to feel weak and subservient. So we can create this sense of being powerful, having money, having influence, having good health, and all the best we have, you know, the sense of power. And then when we're poor and homeless and sickly, then we feel victims and weak, and our lives become very depressing. So in contemplate, you know, then the Buddha established a monastic sangha on powerlessness, you know, that we're taking young people and stripping them of the power symbols and the ability to assert themselves in powerful individual ways. So when you come into the sangha, you give up your title, your position in society, whether you're from the bottom or the top. This is the equalizer of, you know, it's the alms mendicants. We're alms mendicants, not princes who've left our thrones to devote ourselves to spiritual realization, but alms mendicants. So this is a significant perception at this time, because it seems like an anachronism. It doesn't fit into modern society. It doesn't, you know, it's even in the Catholic Church, you know, very seldom do you see, you know, alms mendicancy is almost, if there is any, is hidden away. And in England, for example, Catholic nuns look just like housewives, frumpy housewives. They no longer have a kind of distinctive habit to wear. And so, I find, you know, it's my own personal view, because of the power of this, of just the monastic robe. And because it is a rather impractical garment, as Ajahn Khusla probably is well aware. And drive a tractor and do all kinds of things with your robe on. a lot of people have various opinions of why not change and, you know, adapt more to modern times. And it's a tempting thought, you know. It's not that I'm so devoted to wearing robes that I couldn't possibly think of changing. In fact, sometimes I wish we could change. But the tradition is like this. And then I do see the significance of the pirith. I see the bhikkhu as a kind of archetype, really, rather than, you know, it's a symbol from almost, you know, that transcends cultural conditions, like the four Devadutas that awaken Prince Siddhartha, where the old person, the sick one, the corpse, and the monk. So it's now all these, you know, the first three are common to every culture. Everybody gets old, sick, dies. And then the samana, or the individual that is given up the worldly values to seek the truth, is in various cultures and religions, they have their own equivalent for that. But this one, the Buddhist monk, is certainly that has managed to survive in its appearance and in its tradition for 2,553 years. So I'm not about to muck around with it. It speaks for itself. And so my experiment living in the UK all these years is to see what the effect of it is, you know, living in a European country that's not Buddhist in this way, wearing these robes, and depending on alms, just to see what is it like—an experiment, whether you know it works or it doesn't work. And so, you know, I've been in the UK 33 years now, going on 34. So it's, you know, obviously it has worked. There's no great difficulties in terms of, you know, in fact, the problems are an abundance of requisites. I used to be very thin, you see, in England. So in Thailand, I was very, very, very thin, and in England, I've become fat. So, and so that is due to the, you know, the abundance of offerings made, and starvation is not a problem, or shelter, robes, or medicine. So that works, and then there is this interest in meditation now all over the world, which is showing an awakening. I see Buddha's teaching is about awakening. In fact, the word Buddha means awakened, one who's awake, and or fully present, you know, not just sitting here with eyes open, but fully alert to the present and enlightened, seeing things as they are rather than through biases, cultural biases, or cultural conditioning or personal perceptions. So this of course is where wisdom lies, is in this awareness. Where then discernment? Because if we're just caught in the dualistic function of thinking, then we're stuck in that realm of dualism, of, you know, of thinking and preferring one thing over another, right and wrong, true and false. But in the perspective of mindfulness, then that puts us into a universal conscious reality. That isn't, you know, that it has isn't based on culture. It's a natural. It's Dhamma. It's the way things are. So there's this teaching and scriptures that I like. In fact, at Amravati, I've used it for the past several years, and everybody's had to memorize it. And it is there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. And because there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, there is escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. So to me, this is a significant statement of reality in a rather neutral style. It's not inspiring. It's not, it doesn't have any kind of anthropomorphic symbols in it. It's just a very pure intellectual statement of Dhamma. So there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. And now that's, in the Pali form, say, Ati Bhikkhave Ajatang Aputang Akatang Asankadang. It says, Ati Bhikkhave, there is, because it's a statement, it's not a supposition or a theory. So it's stated as a fact. There is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. Now that, and therefore there is escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. And if there was not the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, there'd be no escape. We'd be stuck in the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. I mean, we were just helpless victims of our births, having a human body and the situation we were born into, the family, the parents, the conditions. Some are fortunate, some unfortunate. I mean, well, babies are born, you know, disabled or with malformations, and not everybody's born healthy and strong and beautiful. And being brought up as a Christian, you know, when I started thinking about, you know, that God created us all and loves us all equally, of course, my childish mind began to wonder, well, why are some better off than others? Why are they beautiful and why they're ugly? Why, and so, you know, if we only have one lifetime, and we're all loved equally and created, why didn't create us all perfect? There's a kind of logic there. And so, you know, then one thinks it's not fair, you know, on the ideal level, that some babies are born with disabilities and others healthy, and some born into poverty and others into wealth and abundance. It's not fair. But that's where in the Buddhist explanation of the law of karma helps, because then we for one thing, we're not just this lifetime is the only chance we have, but we also begin to see that we are the way we are because of karma, which can be not taken so personally, but it's a way of accepting the conditions we find ourselves in. You know, rather than feeling that, you know, that we're victims of fate or unloved by God or inferior to somebody else or whatever, then when we reflect on karma, then this is what we learn from if we have disabilities or disadvantages or advantages or whatever, we learn from this package we're born in, the way it is. And then we have the escape from it through the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. Then, so that is those are the words, they're negations of the opposite. So there's the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned, and then notice that there is the unborn, they're all negations of the other. Because the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned are about phenomena, about blue and red, about tall and short, about black and white, about good and bad, about everything, you know, that has a form, a shape. It can be fantasy. We can create fantasies. We can, you know, have facts, reality, perceptions, and all kinds of creative abilities with form, color, and shape with our intellects, with our minds. We're able to create things with our hands and so forth that have form and that are born, that are created, that are conditioned. So then the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, here and now, at this, while we're sitting here in these forms, what is it? You know? And of course, it's unimaginable. You realize imagination is about form, is about images. And then on the intellectual side, the unborn, uncreated, sounds like annihilation. It's nothing. It's blank. It's nihilistic. And then the Buddha, in his first sermon, said, this is the middle way, the Majjhima Patipatta, neither the eternal nor the annihilationist extreme. So then the teaching is about the suffering, it's how it arises and how it ceases. And through that, then we, within these mortal forms, conditioned forms, in whatever state they happen to be in at the present, the escape from them isn't mean we get rid of them, but we see them in perspective from the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. So that is the, and then when we emphasize mindfulness, that is the way that we do that. We can actually, through practice, through investigation of Dhamma, recognize we have this no ultimate reality while still within the limitations of these mortal forms. So that's quite amazing when you think of it, at least to me it is. That and then we have perspective on the conditions that we have to bear with in our lives. Whatever that might be, because each person's karma is different from another. So, you know, but what we share in common is we get old, get sick, and die. That's common human condition. And we have to experience loss, grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish are common human experiences that we can relate to. And whether you're in the Amazon jungles with tribal people or in New York City or wherever, it's still the same. Human emotions are much the same thing, and we have that common bond. When we get into our own particular conditioning, then we get into comparing. We might consider we're more advanced than some tribe in the Amazon jungle. We're civilized and they're not. So then we start creating perceptions of better or superior, inferior, and so forth. And that's through, not through wisdom, but through conceit, through ignorance, through believing our own particular conditioning, cultural conditioning. Now, the way out of the whole thing is not to, you know, stop thinking or just annihilate the condition, but to realize the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. And that's like the third noble truth is that this realization. Reality, we have recognized where this is real, this is reality. These other conditioned things are what they are. You know, we're not trying to dismiss them, but they are only what they are in the present moment because they're changing. And in this way, we can really discern the difference between the conditions, the conditioned and the unconditioned, or grasping and non-grasping, or suffering and non-suffering, or self and non-self. So this is what, in this Buddhist sense of banya or wisdom, is to discern, to know from intuitive level, gut level kind of knowledge of the unborn, uncreated. It's not something you can find, but you are that. And through letting go of the form, the created, till there's nothing left, then that's it. So in many ways that can sound terrifying, because we invest a lot in becoming things. And it's very difficult to sometimes let go of certain very sacred conditions that we have, make us feel secure and worthy in some way or another, give us some sense of security. So it's going into total insecurity, uncertainty. And of course, Ajahn Chah's famous statement in Thai, Mainna, it's always, Mainna means don't know, uncertain. And so he was always, and that uncertainty is where the thinking mind actually stops. You know, because we, you know, from my own experiments with this investigation, how I felt personally, emotionally ill at ease with not knowing things. I want to know. I want to feel secure. I feel secure even if you tell me lies. I remember, you know, going away from Amaravati one time and meeting Ajahn Veerdhamma at the airport in London, and I just wanted him to say, everything is all right. Don't tell me anything that might upset me. Tell me everything is okay. Because, even though, I wouldn't, that's what I wanted to hear, because if everything is okay, then, my emotional tendencies then will, what a relief. And they say, if Ajahn V had said, well, Ajahn, there are some real problems in them. Then I go into a kind of a tense state. Now now observing this, this is the conditioning process, the personality, the social conditioning. And then the knowing of it. So then the knowing of that conditioning isn't about having any views about it, but recognizing it is like this. Feeling tense and upset because there's so many problems at the monastery is like this, or recognizing everything is okay, emotionally, that kind of soothes everything, makes life more agreeable. So there is a lot of, in our society's attempts to don't tell me anything. Just say you love me even though you don't, or say everything is all right even though it isn't. and then we have various the technology of distracting ourselves into inane sitcoms on the telly and Big Brother programs, and they reach Canada, Everybody tells all their problems on national television now. It's very un-English. But they do it there, confess on national television. Tell all about their marital problems and sexual problems and whatnot. Everybody to hear. Well, this is a different time. And it seems to be, you know, everybody's interested. It's a greatly popular television program. I've never seen them, actually, but hear about them. But the human condition is like this. It's we're an absurd species in many ways. You know, we're pretentious and conceited, and we think we're better than what we really are. So because we do have these retentive memories, we can create with our minds. We can refine things. We can live in a realm of intellectual refinement. We can seek a more kind of peaceful states of mind through meditation. We can develop more aesthetic tastes than just coarse ones. So we have this mentality that can reach up into the heavens like Devadas and Brahma gods, or we can slip down into the lower realms of animal that eat, sleep, and procreate, or we can slip into the Preta realms, hungry ghosts and demons. You can see we hear the news of various grotesque serial murders and things like that. How can a human being do such wicked, cruel, and atrocious acts? It's because we have this kind of mind. We're quite capable of refinement, of ultimate, of very high refined states and very low demonic ones, and all gradations in between those two extremes. So then the Buddhist monk, Buddhist samana, is a symbol, kind of an iconic symbol of, say, humanity, where it's taking responsibility for action and speech, morality, and a level of dependence on the goodness of the society one lives in. So we're not trying to create ourselves as some kind of priesthood that has power over the society, or to just turn away from the society because we want nothing more to do with worldly conditions. But the Buddha, in his wisdom, attached us to the society through our dependency on our requisites, like his breakfast this morning and the meal, and these are like food, shelter, robes, and medicine. So it's a very interesting, to me, it's been very interesting to see the power of that symbol, where, say, from the American view of normal behavior, say, for my generation, was be a winner, be successful. These kind of ideals were very much, the ideals for men of my generation. And so this was we did have Christian priests and we had monks, but the monastics were rather remote. I remember we were brought up in the Episcopal Church, in a very high church, a very what they call Anglo-Catholic church in Seattle, and it was very ceremonial. And so every year, Anglican monks from Santa Barbara, Holy Cross Monastery in Santa Barbara, would come to Seattle, and give meditations and that, and they would stay at my parents' home. So this is my encountering with monks then. But they were living in rather remote places and were rarities. They didn't seem to be part of the society. They seemed to be outside it. But in Thailand, I noticed that the monks are very much a part of the society. They're everywhere and in every village, and even in a cosmopolitan city like Bangkok, if you go out at dawn in the morning, you know, it's quite inspiring to see monks out barefoot walking on cement pavements with their alms bowls and people waiting with food to offer. And when we stay in Bangkok, we stay right off Sukhumvit Road, which is the main road that goes through Bangkok, with this electric trestle train above us. It's quite exciting to walk barefoot with your alms bowls in the morning along the cement, which is not very nice feeling with the bare feet, especially when you've been living in England wearing shoes for years, and then huge lorries zoom by, and then these electric trains overhead. It's like anachronism of fate, of suddenly you're something like out of 2,500 years ago thrown into this ultra-modern cement city that with all these powerful things happening around, these huge lorries and this electric train. But still within that, the kind of touching thing is there are these people waiting with alms food to offer. And so even in a modern city like that, you have this, which is something that looks maybe old-fashioned or out of place, but it also has its own magic, even in within such an environment as that. And, of course, people there would be absolutely devastated if we didn't go out on our bindabat run. Because it's part of the culture, you know, this is their opportunity. So it's the point of this is that this generosity, the samana, the alms mendicant, arouses these good qualities in people, generosity. Because they have to prepare food, they have to get up early and wait, and maybe there won't be a monk walk by or whatever, but there's this, they always try to make the best food they can think of. Nobody just gives you the worst thing, the leftovers from the night before, but they actually put forth, you know, a lot of effort in providing us with good food, not through our demand, but through their own good-heartedness. So this also is the sense that human beings' nature is based on, you know, when you get to this empty, unborn, unconditioned, it's not a kind of blank annihilation, nothingness, but it's where compassion can operate, can flow. Where, you know, it's not through me, Ajahn Sumedho, practicing compassion anymore as some kind of personal, you know, my view of compassion and me trying to prove I'm compassionate, but it is a natural manifestation through the empty consciousness. So then these Brahma-viharas, what they call the Brahma-viharas, the Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upeka, they come from that. They're not personal qualities. You know, when I try to practice Metta, you know, it tends to be difficult because, you know, like you can... It's easy to feel metta, as I said, for a billion Chinese in China than for one monk who you're having problems with in the monastery. You know, because on the intellectual level, you can, you know, a billion Chinese in China are not immediate threat. They're over there, and I don't know one of them. Matt and Mark, who I might know very well, is dedicated to Dhamma Vinaya, who I don't get on with, brings up emotion, you know, feeling. And so, you know, one likes the concept of metta or loving kindness. You know, we all would like to be that way. But then in terms of the reality of our situations, the conflicts, the irritations, the frustrations of living in families and communities, you can't just pretend that you have metta or, you know, in a personal way for someone that you're very angry with or hate. But what you can do is recognize this condition. Like, you know, when one feels angry or averse to somebody, you know, then one can, you know, have metta for that kind of emotion, meaning not, it isn't like, you know, agreeing with it, but it is acknowledging its presence. You have to, you know, you need to acknowledge your anger as it's like this, or your resentments as they arise in consciousness. They are what they are, but refrain from judging them as personal faults, because then we feel guilty. If we're attached to the idea of having metta, and then we feel anger and resentment towards somebody that we should have metta for, then we tend to feel guilty. So one of the big obstructions that people face is guilt complexes. I don't know about Canada, but in the UK, people are always guilty because they suffer a lot from feeling guilty. And so this is quite, you know, a big neurotic problem for us. And what is it that makes us feel guilty? And then exploring that, it's, you know, we are, you know, we can, if you, you know, like Buddhists, people interested in Buddhism will attach to the kind of ideals of it, about loving kindness, and then feel guilty about what they're actually feeling in the moment, because it's not loving kindness they're feeling. And so then they tend to see it as, I shouldn't feel like this, that I should forgive, I should love people, they can't help the way they are. That's being very rational about it, but no matter how rational and clever your intellect might be, your feelings are like this, you know. So in this way, you're actually noticing what you're feeling, you know, like resentment, that emotions are not reasonable. You know, there's no reasonable, they are what they are, but you don't have sensible, rational, reasonable emotions. Emotions are not that way. So, but you can have rational, sensible, reasonable thoughts and ideas. So this way of acknowledging what you're feeling is not justifying or defending it, but recognizing that this feeling of resentment or anger is like this, and then to see it in terms of arising, ceasing, rather than creating it into your kind of faults. You shouldn't feel like this. These kind of inner voices that are always condemning you and telling you what you should and shouldn't feel. But then as you begin to recognize the empty consciousness with awareness, then and wisdom, then these things resolve themselves. And then the metta, karuna mudita upeka, manifests from emptiness. You know, so they're appropriate to particular situations. And then equanimity or upeka is like most of our life is neither, you know, particularly filled with mudita or compassion, but it's this way. It's a balanced sense of equanimity that we know. We abide in that rather than in, you know, endlessly trying to, you know, churn up things or to just ignore life. So these four Brahma Viharas, then they're called divine abodes sometimes, or they're not from the created state of the Sakya Ditti Tilabhata Brahmasa Vichikicha. And they manifest through letting go of conditions rather than trying to control or judge or ignore conditioned phenomena. So in the metta practice, the first, in the formal, chanting of it, may I abide in well-being, we start with this simple phrase, Ahang Sukhito Homi, may I abide in well-being. Well, that taken on the ego level, or is it just a reminder to have a sense of acceptance of the conditions you're experiencing now? You know, whatever emotions you're feeling or conditions you're experiencing, it's this sense of metta, of allowing them to be what they are without you claiming them or judging them or trying to get rid of them. Because, these conditions, it's an honest reflection. Whatever you're feeling now, it is like this. Whether it's good or bad, right or wrong, some, you know, but it's not the point, is it? Because all you need to know is that what you're feeling is this way. And then your reaction would be, if you're feeling resentful, and I shouldn't feel this way, or I shouldn't, it's because somebody else treated me unfairly, it's their fault. And so we get into this proliferating, blaming sense, or either somebody else or ourselves. But in this simple reflection, it's just a simple acceptance of what you're feeling in the present, and patiently allowing it to be that way. And through that, you're actually more and more abiding in the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, to where these various emotional habits that you experience are in perspective of arising and ceasing, birth and death. So that's discerning, isn't it? You discern they are what they are. All conditions arise and cease. There is the unborn, uncreated. And in reading Western philosophy and that, they've never really discovered this paradigm. I mean, like in Britain now, you get all this, Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and these kind of critics, religious critics, claiming there isn't any God and whatnot, and so it's an endless controversy around whose views and whose opinions. Is there a God or isn't there? And you can't prove there is one, and therefore there isn't any. And then the Christians say, well, there is. We feel this presence, and but you can't prove it. And of course, proving that in terms of conditioned phenomena, the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, you can't prove in terms of conditioned phenomena because it's not that. But you can recognize it. And it's real. It's not. It's a fact. It's not a fantasy. And it's not a special refined condition that depends on other special refined conditions. So it's just this awakened consciousness here and now. And then more and more, by reminding yourself of that, it begins to click, the penny drops, and then you know, this is it. And then so I'll stop here.
Antamayang tamo owa takata satu kalang tatama se. Sa.